Welcome to this series on metabolic health. Welcome to this latest installment from In the Know. This one's on metabolic health. You might have listened to the dozen or so I did on longevity or all the other tech and innovation stuff over the year. This one's really exciting. It's really topical. Ozempic's been all over the news. Buckle up, because we're going to get under the covers. It's Amol Sarva here, and I've got Dr. Maya Kelberer today. One of the leading people on the area of the gut microbiome. You've been hearing about gut health. Maybe you're drinking kombucha. Well, let's figure out what's going on with the gastroenterology of all this stuff and hear about some of the new directions folks are pursuing.
Maya Kelberer, the gastronaut.
Exactly.
Or one of the gastronauts.
The director of gastronauts.
And my goal for our conversation here is just to explore your interests in these themes and how you came to them.
Yeah, of course.
Where you think they're going and how they took you to the Galapagos, I guess. Is that where the first gastronauts get together was?
Actually, no. It was at Duke University in 2016. And so the Galapagos was actually our fourth symposium.
But tell me more about it. I mean, so you're a professor in the medical school at Duke. You're a neurogastroenterologist, which I guess we know about the gut-brain axis.
Right. I would say that I'm a sensory neurobiologist. So what I'm really interested in is how it is that we take the physical world and then how is that then transduced so that neurons can understand it. So how do we transduce light in our retina or sound in our ear? And our gut is kind of this last wild west of the sensory systems where we didn't really know much of anything about how we sensed in the gut. We knew that the gut released a lot of hormones and that that would communicate with the brain in kind of an indirect way. And so when I started my postdoc in 2015, I started with a new faculty at Duke, Diego Borges, and he had this idea that there might be a closer connection based on a couple of experiments that he'd done. We're working to try and identify whether or not there was this true neuronal transduction sense in the gut. So some kind of gut epithelial interaction. And this is what we actually found, was that there are these subset of cells that are sensory cells, and they take the stimuli within the gut, nutrients, chemicals, thermal, mechanical sensation, and they transduce it onto the brain. So now you can communicate rapidly to the brain what is going on in your gut lumen.
I mean, I don't know, it's a sixth sense, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of a sixth sense. And why I start out by saying I'm a sensory neurobiologist is what I find fascinating about this is that there are certain visual illusions or auditory illusions that we have that are a direct result of how the early circuitry is working in your ear or in your eye. Because ultimately, our senses aren't evolved to tell us the truth. They're evolved to tell us what is going to help us survive. And so they have a tendency to accentuate things that are important to our survival. So if we can understand how this gut sense circuitry is working, then we can understand why it is that certain foods seem to drive more consumption when they really shouldn't be driving more consumption. Or why other foods that are really good for us, we have a really hard time staying on that, the bandwagon of continuing to consume these things.
Well, I guess the oversimplification on that is just like why it's sugar intoxicating or whatever.
Sugar and fat.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I suppose the spot that you're at on it is figuring out what about the machinery in the gut is creating these reactions. The sort of purpose of figuring it out, of course, is to decode how different foods are pressing different buttons and why. But on this machinery stuff, so this sensory neurogastroenterologist.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's quite complex, right? It's not just, it doesn't seem to reduce, like, you can sort of think about the five senses as each having like a real vector. But when you were describing the nature of this epithelial perception, it's like picking up lots of different stuff. I mean, there's heat and there's probably chemistry and I don't know. It's a mingling of many of the senses, I suppose. Maybe just not hearing. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot being perceived.
Yeah. Well, if you think about it, hearing is actually an extension of touch, because hearing is simply the vibration. There is mechanosensation in the gut as well. So you're also feeling those vibrations. You could think of sight in a way as also vibrations, because
well, to the extent that everything light. Reduces to just physical, yeah,
but then we have the chemosenses. So this is where I make a little bit of the distinction. So the olfactory system is also pretty complex in how it's sensing all of these different smells. The taste system is a little bit more narrow and yet is still very rich in what it's sensing. And the way I think about it is that if you look back evolutionarily, the gut sense, I think, was probably the first sense. You have this initial multicellular organism. This organism, what does it have to do? It has to decide to eat or not to eat. So it has some little cell that senses a little bit of the chemicals. And if that chemical is the right chemical to eat, it releases something on the inside. And then your little multicellular organism moves towards that source and consumes it. So if you think about it in that way, now it makes sense why the gut sense is so multifaceted. Because it was kind of where all of the senses got born from. And then some of them might have just shifted a little bit more to one area or another.
This is a standard path to go down as an academic, of course. You know, who is to be master? It's always the thing that you're working on is the
foundation. Of course, clearly.
But yeah, I mean, so maybe there's some interesting things that you've uncovered. Because, I mean, you've got this paper on sugar versus sweeteners. And it occurred to me that some people prefer sweeteners, like non-sugar to sugar. But I suppose that anything is possible. And there's some countries where people don't really use sugar as much as they use some other stuff. Yeah, maybe you can lay that out a bit.
Yeah, so this was a great follow-up paper because, you know, we found the connection and suddenly people are like, well, so what? Why would you have a gut sense? Why would you have a sense that could tell you something that your smell and your taste hadn't already told you? And we had learned, or this had been known for a while, that if you infuse these real sugar versus artificial sweetener into the gut, the animal is able to make this distinction.
So infuse, we're talking about mice when you say.
Yeah, we're talking about mice. They just go straight in. And so we'd found then that these sensory transduction cells that we call neuropod cells were able to distinguish between this artificial sweetener and this caloric sugar. And so that what this is telling us is that, and the way I conceptualize it, is that the gut sense is kind of a sense of how satisfying was your food or how gratifying was the food that you ate. And so when you eat something and you feel that gratifying sense, that's going to drive you to consume. But you brought up a great point with humans. Some people do like artificial sweetener, and it's true. In my coffee, I prefer artificial sweetener as opposed to sugar. But I prefer artificial sweetener because I feel like it doesn't make my coffee as heavy. And so it's almost like I know that it doesn't have caloric value, and that's why I'm choosing it, because we as humans have this cognitive aspect of how we make food decisions.
Well, the flavors are different. I mean, they're not, it's not that one is less, I don't know, something than the other. They are just slightly different flavors in the same ballpark. And I could imagine somebody just liking a different one. Is it to some extent, is it a culturally situated phenomenon, the preference for sweetness? And this, I guess the mice that you studied didn't have particular culture.
Sure,
I wonder. So if there is a measurable sort of satisfaction reward that you found with mice, and to the extent that you've been finding it in people, and that this sense in the gut is giving you this like reward, I mean, the character or the flavor of that, like differentiation, because with taste and with smell, there's whatever, the 40,000 different things we can smell. And how is it parameterized to your knowledge at this point? Or are we still just starting to figure out how the sense perceives?
I think we're just starting to figure out how the sense perceives. And a lot of the times we get a little limited. If you look at kind of the early literature, you find, I think it's in the Odyssey or something, that they talk about how the ocean is like a dark wine or something like that. But there's no real word for blue. And there's no word for blue, even though we can sense it, because we couldn't really make the blue color. And then it becomes this time when we are able to make a blue dye that people suddenly bring this into their scope of quote-unquote perception. And so sometimes I think it's that we just don't have the words to talk about it. We all have a gut sense. And in my research group, we're at the point of trying to identify what that gut sense is. But without the words to communicate it, we just don't know how to talk about it. So the more that we do the research, the more I come up with these phrases like, oh, it's satisfying or it's gratifying. Then I workshop it around and I ask people, well, how did you feel about your food? And then they can think about it a little bit more. And there's a lot of mindfulness research that's going on now to try and get at how it is that we can better know what we're sensing on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds squishy, but yeah, you're right. I mean, it is very Fascinating. I suppose just some more attunement to the phenomenon existing. Like, if you knew, as I now do, as hopefully listeners do, that there is this like sophisticated perception mechanism. And I guess if you had a timeline on it, like how long after you've eaten, it sort of takes a day for your entire system. And where are these sensors? Are they early in there or later? And
so when, really
when
early.
Would you expect to have the phenomenon? You'd expect the phenomenon to be relatively early, like first 30 minutes after eating something, basically.
Earlier than that, actually. I think it happens immediately. So in a mouse, when you're drinking, you get into the small intestine in about 9 seconds. Is what it takes. When you're eating food, it takes a little bit less. For humans, we're just a couple seconds more because obviously we're a lot larger than mice.
But something happens after that. So, I mean, it may start as early as the first 10 seconds and then more has to happen, right? There's
yeah.
Isn't what about this biome we've heard about? There must be some
yes,
kind of
the microbiome.
Bacterial interaction. Mm-hmm.
So the thing is, these cells, like I mentioned earlier, that they're also hormonal. And these hormones are satiety hormones. They make you feel full. So these cells have both the fast signaling in order to drive you to consume something, as well as a slower mechanism that builds up and eventually makes you feel full. So they almost have this duality to them. And yeah, the microbiome, of course, you can't talk about the gut brain without talking about microbes. And we do have some work coming out now about how these neuropod cells in the colon might actually be sensing overall levels of the microbiome. So we have all these microbes and they're very diverse, but they generally have very similar molecular patterns or like bits on them. And every once in a while, they'll shed these off. And one of the big ones is called flagellin. And so they'll release some flagellin into the lumen of the colon. And the neuropod cells in the colon are enriched for a receptor that identifies flagellin, toll-like receptor 5. And when they are sensing the flagellin, the animal will eat shorter meals. So it'll eat slightly less. When they're not sensing flagellin, the animal will eat slightly longer meals and it'll eat a little bit more. And if we then we can use genetics and we can take out toll-like receptor 5 in these colon neuropod cells, and those animals will gradually gain weight. And it's because they can't sense this flagellin signal. And so what we think is going on, this is kind of a way for the host to almost communicate a little bit, because the microbes do a lot of good things for us. When microbe levels are low, they're not releasing as much flagellin, so the animal eats a little bit more. When the microbe levels get higher, it's in the host's best interest for the populations to not grow out of control, so maybe it eats a little bit less. And this is just one facet of this very complex idea of hunger.
And I suppose having found this marker, now you can try to mess with it or see what stimulates it and better understand it. And I suppose, I mean, now that we are kind of in the ballpark of those GLPs we were inspired by in the present interest in the world on all this stuff, the glucagon is one of those two?
Yeah. So this would fall under the category of the hormones that get released from these cells.
So there must be more than a few, right? I mean, I guess there's been so much interest in glucagon for a while that this flagellin is something that we've come to understand more recently.
Yeah. So things like GLP-1, right? This is this is mainly in the media now. GLP-1 is a big satiety hormone. So is cholecystokinin in the small intestine. In the colon, it's peptide YY or PYY. And all of these hormones generally just make you feel full. And this GLP-1 happens to be one of the more potent ones, which is why it's been so effective as things like Ozempic come on the market.
I want to pause for a minute here and talk to you about Life Extension Ventures. It's the reason I'm doing this series for In the Know. Life Extension Ventures is a venture fund dedicated to working towards the longevity of people and planet. The future of humanity depends on our planet surviving. And its potential can really only be unlocked if we focus on some of the technologies, some of the breakthrough science that's making it possible for us to live longer and better lives. Life Extension Ventures is a venture fund focused on supporting visionary founders that are working towards longevity of people and planet. It's the future of humanity that they're working on, and we want to back them. I spent a lot of time as a science person, as an academic, as a student, and then I spent even more time becoming a company builder and venture investor. And with Life Extension Ventures, I'm bringing both of those things together with my partner, Iñaki Berenguer. He's got a similar story. And we're out there finding folks who want to build companies that can really make a difference for human life. We'll need this planet if we want to survive, and we'll need to focus on these breakthrough technologies if we really want to unlock human potential. So here we are doing it, and sharing with you this episode is some of the breakthrough science that we've been learning about and trying to back.
I mean, is the idea that these, I mean, they get sort of produced in the gut and then they circulate around and they're operating in the brain? Is that the idea? Or are they pressing a button on
peripheral neurons as well?
On peripheral neurons, meaning just the whole.
So you got, right, you get the brain, right, that's all in the head, and then you have the entire peripheral nervous system. And so it acts on other sensory neurons as well as in the brain.
And I'm curious about that landscape. I mean, so you mentioned PYY, GLP-1. Are we due for some more, I guess, intervention approaches that could impact how we manage nutrition, food, obesity, all this stuff? If everyone's trying to make something that's like a GLP-1 and the variants thereof and address the consequences of that, and then folks are presumably working on parallel ideas that might have similar or greater impact. Is this something that you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, so I keep an eye on it. I like to think of it in a couple of ways. So there's the classic create a pharmaceutical component and use that to treat. But then a little bit more of what we were talking about earlier, identifying the feeling of what you're feeling actually helps a lot of the time. So it's almost like food therapy. And there is now a branch of like nutritional psychiatry that's out there as well, where instead of mindlessly eating, you're mindfully eating. And it could be as simple as being able to identify the feeling to know when, oh, maybe I've eaten enough, or maybe I need a little bit more protein instead of this cake I'm eating. Being able to identify it, I think, helps a lot in a lot of these types of treatments. And I see it as being a combinatorial thing in the future, is that you would have both your nutritional psychiatrist helping you identify how foods are making you feel. Then you have your, most likely, your immunologist that's telling you how certain foods might actually increase or decrease inflammation. And then you also have your gastroenterologist that's telling you more about how it is your hormones are working. And this all together will create your overall good eating habits and health.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a branch, I suppose, of current kind of nutrition, but it's not a very detailed perception. There is this notion that, well, there's like certain portion sizes, or maybe you want to drink water or eat fiber earlier in the course of the meal. But what to be attuned for, I suppose, is what you're hinting at. That sounds so interesting. And I wonder if you have any more color on it. I know it's kind of difficult. You were describing satiety and the surprising fact that the Greeks never used the word blue, even though you sort of imagine Greece to be entirely blue as a country. What in our perception do you think we should be thinking about as we are eating and drinking or not? I mean, not eating also, right? I mean, the perception of hunger is a little bit of a phantasm. Like if you were to not eat at a certain hour, 2 hours later, you're not more hungry. Usually you're just not hungry.
This is this fascinating aspect of it that you don't really get to in animal research, which is that, that for humans, there are so many other social things. Like I have friends who are overweight and they talk to me about the amount of lack of control over when they're hungry and when they're not hungry. Obviously, we in the modern world are very rarely actually hungry. We have food that's so abundantly available to us all the time. But that doesn't make the feeling less real, which is what is really kind of intriguing about the whole thing. And so then how do you tackle this when it's not a physiological need? Because we're, of course, all of us are mostly satiated all the time, but you do have this drive. There's this feeling of hunger.
That's kind of what I was hoping to parse a little bit. I mean, there's definitely a lot of variation. And I guess just in sort of vernacular language about this, there's the I could have a snack. And there's another kind of thing, which is like the feeling of hunger pangs, where you've come to the point where you, for some reason, it's not pain, but you feel like your stomach is grumbling. There's something there that's like a little bit different. And maybe short of that, there's some other, something that would prompt you to say, I am hungry, but I don't even know exactly how to describe that feeling. But I mean, you could sort of categorize the types of hunger a little bit or put them on some kind of scale. I mean, how do you even, when you're talking about people feeling satiated most of the time, are you satiated when you haven't eaten for 1 hour, for 12 hours, for 24 hours? Because, you could probably lose 5 or 10 pounds by just not eating for days and days, right?
Right.
And you wouldn't be at any great peril most of the time if we were in some period of famine. So I'm just curious how to parse the language of hungry and the motivation to eat.
I mean, and you kind of hit on it exactly. That's what makes this so complex, is that hungry to me means something different. Hungry to you means something different. When we're in the basic science, hungry means when the mouse goes and eats the food.
Without prompting, meaning that food is always available. And
food is always available.
But in sleep research, for example, and there are other fields like this, like sleep, for example, I believe the sort of definition of not tired would be that if you were able to lie down for 20 minutes and not fall asleep, mm-hmm. then you're definitely not tired. And apparently the shorter duration before you fall asleep means you're a bit more tired. And then there's some measurement of, you know, sleep dead against some averages. Mm-hmm. So there's like some notion of like what norms would be. And that's why these sleep people are always telling you, you got to sleep 8 to 9 hours. And in food, in the world of food and nutrition, like, I guess there's like a calorie target, which is an estimate of the total energy consumption of your body based on mass, but it doesn't relate to hunger. You never talk about hunger in food research.
Right. And it's just weird to get at, right? Because the other aspect that we haven't brought up is the social aspect of it. People tend to be hungry when they go out with their friends because, of course, you know, you sit down with a meal with people.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they also say, there's also some research that says if you eat with other people, you're more likely to lose weight.
That definitely makes sense. Yeah. I mean, just personal experience. There really is no measurement on this concept of hunger.
I'm sure that there's probably in the clinic, I don't know of anybody who has defined it as, usually we define it as like you haven't eaten, you fasted, you bring in someone who's fasted for X amount of time. And then that's reported in the study that people were told to have been fasted for 24 hours. And then they come in and they do this.
Because you couldn't use blood sugar either. Because blood sugar modulates so much, it's not directly related to...
Also, our body is very good at maintaining our blood sugar rate, regardless of how much you've eaten. That's why we have all of our fat stores.
So yeah, I wonder what else it could possibly be. So whatever that sensation is of being hungry, it's, I mean, it's just immaterial. Like, you can't explain it. It's just, it's only self-reported to the extent in our discussion here.
But, yeah.
Because it could also be very much circadian, right? It's like... You're on some
and
schedule.
It is, right? You get hungry at certain times during the day. Personally, I usually get hungry at night. This is my dinner is the main meal that I'm hungry for. But if I didn't eat dinner and I woke up the next morning, I would be hungry the next night. I wouldn't be more hungry in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I think that pattern is true for everyone. Mm-hmm. I mean, the folks who are on some pattern are sort of convinced that it's natural and unshakable. Mm-hmm. And once you experiment with something different, it turns out you're not really a breakfast person or like, oh, you can skip lunch. And in theory, you could do in the intermittent fasting type folks that will skip basically all day. That also can feel fine after a few days. And in my own experiments, just basically full 24 hour or 48 hour is also very doable. But there is certainly an experience to this like change in energy source, I think probably like. When you're going from, let's say, blood sugar to glycogen to ketones, it definitely feels different when you're long into having fasted.
Right.
And I don't know that we didn't touch on whether you think that relates, because it's a longer term effect to this, like the sort of gut perception we were talking about. Is it an energy, like ketones versus glycogen sort of difference?
It's probably a little bit of the energy. It's also a little bit of your brain. Adjusting the focus. Yeah. So, of course, your brain uses a lot of energy. So it's very tuned to the amount of glucose you have going around. And so then when this happens, right, your focus shifts. So I think that, like, in a way, real hunger is like when you're really focused on food and you're focused on when the next meal is going to be. If you've been fasting for like 24, 48 hours, that's where I notice the difference, is that my attention has been now shifted into this one thing. And we certainly have systems that pick up in our blood, like our liver mostly, that's monitoring how it is that your nutrient level is. Whether that's true hunger or not, in a philosophical sense, is kind of where I'm putting this question.
Yeah, it's intriguing. This is definitely a thing. Like, there's a pain scale. It's definitely like a sleep scale.
But even the pain scale is subjective.
But at least that you ask the patient, they tell you 1 or 10. But on the hunger scale, has anyone, I've never even heard the question asked.
I'm sure you could ask them.
Except by my mother on a road trip. It would be easy to establish, of course. And maybe it's not useful at all, but it is quite curious.
Yeah.
Because it's a thing that lives entirely in the world of perception. There doesn't seem to be an easily observable sort of third-party driver as we're exploring the topic of hunger, even though the desire to eat or the related hunger phenomenon is the thing that drives so much consumption. And while there are these great neurotransmitters that come from, you know, bacteria in the gut, those neurotransmitters may or may not actually be, well, it's unclear what we're measuring. Are we measuring hunger or not, or just the prompts to eat, continue eating or stop eating? So, I mean, it's quite fascinating.
Yeah, area. I mean, yeah, we study the drive to consume or to not consume, because at the basic research level, that's all we can study. And then we call it hunger, hungry or not hungry. But we can force a mouse to eat and know that it's not hungry. We can force a mouse not to eat and know that it is hungry, based on which regions we activate or inhibit.
It's such a fascinating area that you have uncovered. And I guess it's the early days. I mean, your first papers on this are just in the last 5 years or so. So it's like we have a lot to stay tuned for.
Yeah. And then, this was all, you had asked me about gastronauts early on, and then I launched into science initially. But this was actually the impetus for starting gastronauts. So back in 2015, we're trying to put together, what does this gut sense mean? Is it even possible? How do we study it? And so we started, Gastronauts started at Duke as a monthly seminar series where we invited different people from different fields, anything related to food, the gut, and the brain, to come and just give a talk. And the goal was to make it multidisciplinary, was to just bring in anybody within the field just to see how they were thinking about the field. So I remember one early gastronauts, we had some nurses that dealt with, they were nutrition nurses for children, and they dealt with autistic kids. And we had this great conversation on what kinds of food do autistic kids eat and how do they address getting them to eat better, because they have a tendency to have a limited repertoire of food they eat. And so then this gastronauts grew from there to our first symposium that we held at Duke, which was in 2016, so that we could bring more outside speakers. Then our next one was in 2018 in Singapore, where we partnered with Duke Singapore there. In 2020, we ended up being virtual because it was COVID, but it was supposed to be in Nantes. And then, as you mentioned, in 2023, we were in the Galapagos for a symposium. And so then the goal of the symposium isn't necessarily just go to these cool places, because the Galapagos is pretty cool, but it's to partner with the local scientific community. And so when we were in Ecuador, we partnered with the University of San Francisco de Quito, which is this large private university in Quito. And it has one of the only PhD programs in the country for microbiology. And so what we were able to do is bring these researchers from all over the world, as well as within Ecuador. And we brought them together in this idea of like, well, how do we emphasize the power of both sides? And how do we create collaboration and communication between these people? And so one thing with Ecuador that really pulled out was diversity. So a lot of people don't necessarily know this, but Ecuador has a little bit of the Amazon, has a high desert region, a coastal region, then it has the Galapagos, where most people have heard of. And so it spans all of this plant and animal diversity that most countries could only dream of having. And it shows in their science that that's actually the strength of what their science is. So now we can bring these investigators who are like, you know, in Scandinavia, where plant diversity is not as great. They come down and then they see this opportunity to make a collaboration between the work that they're doing and then this the work that's being done in this region.
Will you be doing gastronauts in Ecuador again?
Well,
or you're going to visit other, you know, biologically interesting landscapes?
So the next one's actually going to be in 2025. We're doing it on the Mississippi River. So the idea here is that the Mississippi is almost like the gut of America, right? Everything goes into it. It feeds everything. And so in this sense, we're partnering with Mayo Clinic so that we can put more of a medicine spin on the research that we're bringing in. But like all gastronauts, it's people who are interested in food, the gut, and the brain. It'll be a global community. We'll bring in people from all the different disciplines that have something to do with this.
How cool. Well, Maya, thank you for telling us about this. Let's consider this the advertisement in our program for this exciting seminar that's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
But thanks for spending time talking to us about your work. I mean, it's really fascinating. And I guess truly at the frontier of how people are thinking about, I don't know, one of the central issues in our experience, certainly.
We already talk about it, our gut feeling. You have feelings about things. It's like, that's true. I have a gut feeling. We're just trying to define what that gut feeling is.
Thank you so much.
I hope that was an interesting conversation for you. For me, it was really interesting with Dr. Kale Bearer, and I hope you'll check out the other episodes.